Ashble.
Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
This is the Talking Information Center, a window to independence through local volunteers reading over 300 newspapers, magazines, and books specific to your community.
Now available on your smart speaker by saying, play radio station Talking Information Center.
For comments and more information, call 781-834-4400 or visit ticnetwork.org.
Thank you for listening.
WBBF Middleboro, WRRS Middleboro, WRRSLP Pittsfield, WLLO Londonderry, WBAOLP Athol, WDJ. Framingham.
Here we go now with the reading of today's Boston Herald for this Friday, the 10th of July, 2026. You're listening to the Talking Information Center, and we say hello to Bob and Dottie.
Thank you, John. And we have three front page stories to read for you before this morning to start off. And our first front page story: world-class show. Bay State shines as cup host. It woke the city up. That's in quotes. World Cup gave Boston a major boost. And this is by Lance Reynolds. With the World Cup matches wrapping up in Foxborough, the soccer world says there is a clear winner of the premier global tournament. And it's not one of the final teams standing. I think Boston won the World Cup, Revolution President Brian Bilello's told the Herald inside a packed Boston Stadium amid France's 2-0 shutout. I should say 2-0, because that's what they do in the soccer world, of Morocco in the tournament's first quarterfinal match. Bilello's triumphant declaration caps off a month-long multicultural carnival that helped alter the region's sporting identity in a summer that has seen a middling Red Sox team test the city's patience. Hundreds of thousands of international visitors flew into Greater Boston over the past month to support their countries in the tournament, generating a massive regional economic boon that local and state officials say will have tremendous lasting power. The most positive spirits that united locals with foreigners, notably Scotland's Tartan Army, stood in stark contrast to the concerns skeptics raised about whether Greater Boston was fully prepared to host such a large-scale, weeks-long spectacle. Boston is Boston, but the crafts paved the way so the World Cup would be a success, PR guru George Regan told the Herald at Thursday's match. Boston needed a shot in the arm, said Regan, who helped the Boston 2026 host committee. Ahead of Thursday's quarterfinal between France and Morocco, SeatPick, a ticket search engine and aggregator, crowned Gillette Stadium, which rebranded as Boston Stadium for the tournament, as the best World Cup venue for fan experience. The study factors in the stadium's average beer cost of $8.58, the second cheapest in at the 11 U.S. host venues, and relatively comfortable temperatures of 83 degrees, despite Thursday's scorching heat that soared past 90 degrees at kickoff. The only real sting comes from hotel prices in the area, which average $611 per night, the highest of all the host cities, the study stated. Fans willing to venture into the greater Boston area may find a much friendlier bill. As music pumped into inside the stadium and fans headed to their seats, a 67-year-old man named Mike took in the scene, offering a jubilant assertion. "The World Cup has made Boston fun. It woke the city up," Mike told the Herald. That stance is resonating strongly with the masses, especially as Bostonians and Bay Staters reflect on their newly formed love affair with Scotland, even 3 weeks after the Tartan Army left the city. "Such an incredible singular city in the United States," Roger Bennett, co-founder of the Men in Blazers Media Network, told Boston Mayor Michelle Wu ahead of the final match. "I adore being here. It is the platonic ideal of a sports town. I believe the city of Boston has already won the World Cup." In his pregame show, Bennett focused on how the Tartan Army ran beer lines at some of the city's busiest bars completely dry and placed bright orange traffic cones on some of Boston's most iconic statues. Wu highlighted how the Scots joined the Haitian fans in a march ahead of the first game on June 13th, a sign of what was to come. The mayor said a traffic cone that has sat on the horse's head on the Duke of Wellington statue in Glasgow is set to be gifted to Boston. "We've seen the benefits to our businesses," Wu said. "We've seen the investment, several mini pitches built, and created that will be here long afterwards. But the impact is even deeper in showing us exactly who we are and how powerful that is," she added. "This generation is going to be forever changed." Dottie?
Thanks, Bob. And now, from Howie Carr, "Thanks for nothing, Mr. Frosty." Ed Markey, 80 years old, and nothing to show for it. "Happy birthday. Happy 80th birthday, Senator Ed Markey. I know it's not officially until tomorrow, but at birthday boy's advanced age, when he's not even buying green bananas anymore, why wait until the arrival of the actual big day? So many memories of Ed Markey, the man that time forgot. If only the rest of us could forget as easily. Every St. Patrick's Day, he used to go to Senate President Billy Bulger's time at Halitosis Hall. He was so petrified of the legislator's ability to redistrict him out of his seat that every year he'd show up to grovel to the State House bosses. Ed Markey, Billy Bulger would intone as he stumbled towards the stage. To a battle of wits, he comes unarmed. Another time, at a different St. Patrick's Day event in Everett, Markey was mumbling about how he got no respect from anyone. "Why doesn't anybody like me?" Markey complained to then-House Speaker George Kavirian, trying to make a joke of it. "Why doesn't anyone like you, Eddie?" Kavirian repeated. "Because you're a seven-letter word that begins with an A. And now the bodily orifice is 80 years old. He's been in Washington for half a century. And no one can remember a single accomplishment since his arrival. It was 1976. Markey's congressman had died, and there was a special election in the middle of the term. What that meant was that Markey could run and not risk his seat in the Massachusetts House, which was unthinkable, because if he lost and didn't have his snout in the public trough, he'd have to get a real job. And all his life, all 80 years, he only had that one real job. And that was 60-plus years ago. Driving the Mr. Frosty soft ice cream truck in Malden with Jimmy's. Back then, the Kennedys were still America's first family. All the ambitious young Democrat polls in Massachusetts tried to mimic them. Longish hair combed over the forehead, fake Harvard North Shore accents, etc. Kmart Kennedys, we called the imposters. Ed Markey was the K-Markiest of the K-Markiest. Kennedys. In the legislature, he was a complete non-entity, just as he has been all these years on Capitol Hill. The only thing that he accomplished at the State House was being such a bodily orifice that his desk was finally moved into the basement next to a boiler. Mr. Frosty made his eviction into a TV ad for Congress. They can tell Ed Markey where to sit, but they can't tell him where to stand. He got elected, and for the last half century in Washington, he's been sitting and standing wherever they have told him to. From Tip O'Neill to Nancy Pelosi to Chuck Schumer. Here's the thing about the first congressional election. Because it was an open seat, a free shot, seven candidates jumped in. Markey won in a landslide with 22% of the vote. Landslide Eddie was on his way. In 1979, post-Chappaquiddick, Ted Kennedy was running for president. A network TV crew was shadowing Teddy for a day in the life piece. Ted's aide, Rick Burke, called Markey's office and got him on the line. There was only one problem. Teddy had no idea who Markey was. "What's his name?" Teddy yelled at his aide. "What's his name?" "Markey," said the aide. "No, no, no," Teddy slurred back. "What's his first name?" A few moments later, as Burke recalled later, the senator nodded, removed his hand from the mouthpiece, and said in a syrupy tone, "Oh, Ed, how are you?" The next evening, the entire exchange ran on Walter Cronkite's newscast. Markey was humiliated, and not for the first time. He tried to run for the U.S. Senate for the first time in 1984, but it wasn't a special election. Markey was going to lose, so he crawled back to his house seat. His then-girlfriend threw him out of a car at the Oak Square Station in Malden. He was humiliated on local TV news when he didn't have a clue when asked the simplest of political questions. He had no idea who the Prime Minister of Israel was. He didn't know which side the U.S. was supporting in Nicaragua. In 2013, he finally made it to the Senate after another special election to replace John Kerry. On his first vote, Markey cast a courageous present. A few years later, he introduced the landmark Green New Deal bill. When the Republicans brought to the floor, he again voted, you guessed it, present. When the Pats won the Super Bowl in 2017, he went on the floor of the Senate to congratulate the Boston Patriots. His finest moment in politics came in 2020. The original Kmart Kennedy became the first Pole in Massachusetts to defeat a real Kennedy, Representative Joseph Kennedy III. In retrospect, it was less of a statement on Markey's ascendancy than on the downfall of the Kennedy dynasty. Now, at age 80, Markey pledges that this will be his last run for public office. As if we didn't know. Thanks for nothing, Mr. Frosty. His primary lead over the insufferable Seth Moulton is shrinking, but he should be able to hold on. I spoke the other day with the GOP candidate, John Deaton. He's going to make an issue of the fact that Markey hasn't actually lived in Massachusetts since most of his constituents were born. He still owns his parents' house, Deaton said, but he pays the absolute minimum water bill in Malden, the rate you pay if you don't even use it, say, the showers. His real residency is a mansion in Chevy Chase, Maryland. You know what the electric rate per kilowatt hour is in Maryland? Deaton asked me. It's 16 cents. In Massachusetts, it's 33 cents. More than double. And all Markey wants to talk about is Donald Trump. Markey mentioned Trump's name 19 times in an hour-long debate in Springfield Wednesday. Even Moulton, who is stage four TDS, only brought up Orange Man Bad 12 times. But for today, let's just say many happy returns, Eddie, to a battle of wits. After all these years, he still comes unarmed. Bob?
Thank you, Dottie. Our next front page story, under the subheading Voting, Fed sending election monitors to Boston, New Bedford. This is by Tim Dunn. The Department of Justice is sending election monitors to two Massachusetts cities this year for the September primary. The directive was announced this week by Assistant Attorney General for the DOJ's Civil Rights Division, Harmeet Dhillon, who named Massachusetts, along with Arizona, Michigan, Minnesota, New Hampshire, and Virginia, as the states the monitors will oversee in their respective primary elections. Dhillon says 15 specific jurisdictions in each state have been selected for monitoring, including Boston and New Bedford in Massachusetts. Quote, this is an important goal that increases voter confidence, and it's also important to make sure our voting is accurate so that every citizen who votes has their vote counted equally without being canceled out by somebody who shouldn't be voting, Dhillon said in a video posted to X. Illegal immigrants use stolen identities to vote in local, state, and federal elections, has been documented in Massachusetts. In May, U.S. Attorney Leah Foley's office announced the arrest of a legal permanent resident from Saugus for allegedly illegally voting in elections since 2008. In February, an illegal immigrant in Boston was convicted in federal court for voting in the 2024 presidential election, among other crimes. In March, the Boston City Council took up legislation that would allow non-citizens to vote in local elections. New Bedford has also had recent issues with voter access, most recently in a March 2024 city election, where one precinct opened without any Republican ballots for nearly an hour, while another ran out of GOP ballots hours before the polls closed. Officials in New Bedford say the city has not been contacted by the DOJ regarding the election monitors. While no official communication has been received by the city or the Board of Election Commissioners to date, federal officials are welcome to observe elections here, New Bedford spokesman Jonathan Darling told the Herald. Dillon also said the monitors will ensure the listed jurisdictions are working to eliminate language barriers, facilitate access for disabled voters, and other issues related to civil rights, something she says the DOJ has done for decades. In 2022, the DOJ sent monitors to 9 jurisdictions during the primary elections that year. In 2024, monitors were sent to a total of 27 jurisdictions, Dillon says. Secretary of State Bill Galvin's office tells the Herald that they are only aware of election monitors coming to Boston for the primary, something Communications Director Deb O'Malley describes as routine and related to federal language requirements on voter ballots. O'Malley says all election monitors are welcome in Massachusetts as long as they do not interfere with voters. Dillon forecasts an even more expanded list of jurisdictions for the general election in November. Toddy?
Thanks, Bob. From the Herald Opinion page, the editorial. What Dems Should Learn from the Platner Debacle. Democrats are scrambling in the wake of Graham Platner's exit from the U.S. Senate race in Maine. One of the questions the party should be asking itself is this: what have you learned from the fiasco? Platner, a military veteran and oyster farmer, was the darling of progressive leaders after Governor Janet Mills dropped out of the race in late April. He was gruff, combative, and primary voters seemed to like that. That's all progressive leaders needed. Senator Elizabeth Warren gushed, "He's my kind of man," a phrase that has aged like milk. Platner's tattoo, resembling a Nazi symbol, pay no mind. After all, he covered it up. But while there were reports of sexting while married, the bottom didn't drop out until a Politico report this week that he allegedly forced a woman to have sex. Platner denied the allegation, but the party was over. Now, all his high-profile supporters, like Warren and Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, are having a teachable moment. Whether they make use of it is up to them. For starters, I quote, "Will this candidate help win us control of the Senate?" End of quote. Shouldn't be the overarching goal. It should be, what does this candidate offer to voters that the others don't? You can't cosplay values. Then there's due diligence. In the business world, job candidates find their social media posts scrutinized, and many have found long ago inflammatory posts come back to bite them. There were reports of old Reddit comments by Platner that appeared to endorse political violence, dismiss rape in the military, and use anti-gay slurs. That was a huge red flag, especially with the tattoo controversy. But too many Dems decided the elephant in the room was merely decorative. Now, of course, the party has to find a new candidate to rally behind. And even though it's a high-profile, high-stress pick, leaders have to do what they did, not with Platner. Vet like nobody's business. Because this isn't just a Maine problem or a Senate control problem. Platner's backers, even though they washed their hands of him, took a serious hit to their credibility. Who you endorse says a lot about you, about shared values, about what you do and do not consider important. The answer to dropping the ball on Platner can't be, well, look at the guys across the aisle. Voters deserve better. Democrats want a turnaround in the midterms and the 2028 presidential election, and they've been criticized and called out for mistakes they've made in past campaigns. Former President Barack Obama told Stephen Colbert in May that what I'm more interested in for Democrats is, do you know how to just talk to regular people like we're not in a college seminar? Can you talk in plain English to folks? As The Hill reported in 2024, Republicans made significant gains with working class voters, not just white voters, but Hispanic voters and some black voters too. That's got to sting and worry Democrats. But supporting candidates who grow more controversial by the minute isn't the way forward for the American, for the party or America. Graham Platner is a cautionary tale. Now, let's see if the lesson sticks. Bob?
Thank you, Dottie. And we have one more front page story for you. from the front page, let him drink. City seeks extension of looser regs. Woo, council wants looser drinking rules to stick around. Those include 3 a.m. last call special zones created for World Cup tourism. This is by Gayla Cawley. Mayor Michelle Wu and the city council want to keep the party going in Boston after the World Cup ends and are pressing state lawmakers to extend 3 a.m. last call hours and public drinking zones through the summer. Wu and the council on Wednesday spoke favorably about a special state law that loosened nightlife restrictions in Boston for the international soccer tournament by allowing the city to set later last call hours at bars and restaurants and implement two downtown social districts where people can legally drink outside. We've had no incidents, Wu said on GBH's Boston Public Radio. The businesses have reported huge gains, and people have been having a great time. I think it's really important that with all that's happening in the world, there are spaces where people can come together and have fun. With the temporary provision set to expire July 31st, city officials are exploring ways to make the changes permanent, which would require Beacon Hill to sign off. We would very much advocate for that, Wu said. It should be on cities to be able to make those decisions, and we are going to continue to advocate for keeping the momentum going. It's not just World Cup and summer events, but all throughout the year. There's something happening in Boston. In the meantime, the council, by an 8-2 vote Wednesday, passed a resolution backing a state Senate bill that seeks to keep the public drinking zones and later bar hours in place through August, or the rest of the summer, as councilors put it. More than 200 establishments now participate, and two social districts operate downtown, City Council President Liz Braden, the regulation's lead sponsor, said. Residents and visitors have embraced the extended hours and social districts. We've hosted the Tartan Army and other World Cup visitors with great success. The city's two social districts opened last month at Union and Marshall Streets in downtown's Blackstone Block Historic District and on Temple Place in downtown Crossing, where people can purchase booze from restaurants and drink outside. Breeden said, summer is just getting started, and pushed for state lawmakers to pass a bill co-sponsored by State Senator Barry Fitzgerald and Julian Sear, and now sits in the Committee on Economic Development and Emerging Technologies. The Senate bill, Breeden said, would keep the fund going and allow cities and towns to continue the program through August. Both Breeden and Wu cited the potential economic benefits from keeping looser drinking restrictions in place in Boston. Sear, a Democrat who represents the Cape and Islands, said Thursday that the bill would actually continue the program for a longer period of time through Labor Day on September 7th. I think there's been a real recipe for change in Massachusetts this summer, and I want to figure out how we can hold on to that, Sear told the Herald. It makes abundant sense for us to extend this through the end of the summer. Also, I've been a longtime proponent of local option by happy hour. We should do that as well. Boston's sleepy nightlife scene has come alive in recent weeks as soccer fans from around the world have flocked to the city to the World Cup. The Scots, known as the Tartan Army, were a particular force, with some local bars reporting that they ran out of beer due to the round-the-clock Scottish drinking. I think it's encouraging to see Massachusetts embracing so much fun this summer, Sear said. Let's find a way to keep it up. City Councilor Brian Worrell made similar arguments last month when he proposed a home rule petition that would allow for last call hours to be permanently extended from 2 a.m. to 3 a.m. in Boston. If approved by the council, the legislation would advance to Beacon Hill for consideration. Worrell, who spearheaded a prior legislative effort that brought 225 new liquor licenses to Boston, said last month that his proposal is about boosting revenue and keeping the city competitive, akin to nightlife offerings from other major cities that allow for later last call hours like New York, Washington, D.C., and Miami. I think we are a fun city, but there's an opportunity to make it a little more fun, Worrell said, told the Herald. We want to be in an area that continues to attract young people. The push to keep the temporary nightlife parameters in place last July 31 has its detractors, with criticism centering around public safety concerns and police staffing constraints in light of last weekend's chaotic and bloody July 4th violence that left 13 people shot and two fatally. Larry Calderon, president of the Boston Policemen's, Larry Calderon, president of the Boston Police Patrolmen's Association, the city's largest police union, said Thursday that the union is 100% against extending 3 a.m. last call hours, giving that police can't manage the calls that we have now. As the police commissioner himself recently stated on the record, booze and big crowds are a bad combo that leads to more trouble, Calderon said in a statement. And really, we couldn't agree more. Extending last call from 2 a.m. to 3 a.m. is a bad idea that invites and encourages bad behavior, and the elected officials pushing the measure should think long and hard about the undeniable negative consequences associated with excessive alcohol consumption. Ed Flynn and Aaron Murphy, the two councilors who have joined the BPPA's call to beef up police staffing levels to counteract violence, voted against Brendan's resolution to extend looser drinking regulations, while the Minyard Culpepper, who represents Roxbury, where most of the July 4th shootings took place, abstained from taking a position by voting present. Dottie?
Thanks, Bob. No negotiations as nurses' work stoppage continues, by Grace Zuckovich. Tensions continued between Brigham and Women's Hospital nurses and management as the work stoppage entered its second day. MGB officials said Boston police and security were on alert after nurses interfered with a patient who arrived at the hospital. While nurses rebutted, no one inside was responding to the emergency. The work stoppage at Brigham and Women's Hospital and MGB home care sites began Wednesday, when Massachusetts Nurses Association members voted to strike after months of contract negotiations failed. The 4,000 BWH nurses finished their one-day strike Thursday morning, but the work stoppage continued due to a four-day lockout ordered by MGB leadership to accommodate what they called, I quote, extensive operational and emergency preparedness measures, end of quote. The nurses are expected to return to work July 13th at 7 a.m. MNA stated there have still been no negotiations at this point as of Thursday evening. We've told everyone, including the governor, mayor, and MGB, that we are ready to negotiate and compromise to resolve the Brigham lockout and MGB home care strike, said MNA spokesperson Joe Markman. We are waiting for MGB to respond. The 450 MGB home care clinicians called a seven-day strike to last through July 15 at 8 a.m. MGB replaced the union members with nearly 1,300 agency nurses at BMC and over 175 home care clinicians. The hospital system has stated they remain fully operational during the stoppage, though the Foxborough Ambulatory Surgery Center will be closed until Friday, and some home care work was placed on pause. And in internal communications, MGB officials responded to what they called false claims that picketing nurses were forced to cross the picket line to help a patient with a medical emergency. The actions by the picketing nurses directly interfered with emergency response efforts, creating unnecessary risk for the patient, who fortunately did not have an adverse outcome, MGB stated in the internal email. Our emergency response process exists to ensure the fastest possible expert clinical assessment and care for patients who need urgent medical attention, and worked fully as intended in this case. An emergency specialized care team was immediately mobilized and arrived within minutes of receiving the call, MGB said. Though the patient had already been escorted elsewhere by the picketing nurses, the hospital system officials called the nurses' action inappropriate and improper, adding, we are in direct contact with BWH security and Boston police to ensure that there is no further interference in patient care. An MNA spokesperson said the nurses called a code blue because of a medical emergency. No one responded from inside, Machman said, adding two nurses had to cross the line to bring the patient inside to get them to the appropriate place. The replacement staff couldn't even use their badges to get into the elevator and didn't know where to go. Video during the incident provided by the MNA shows a large group of nurses gathered outside the hospital around the apparent medical situation, some calling Code Blue OB before cheering as something happens out of shot. In the internal email, MGB officials pulled back on other claims made regarding alleged negative impacts to care at the hospital. Further rifts between the sides appeared as management went on to allege patients and families were disrupted at night because of picketing. Supplies and equipment were missing and tampered with before the strike, and union nurses inhibited the arrival of agency nurses Thursday. On several of the counts, MGB said they were in touch with security, HR, and police. Video from the MNA posted Thursday morning shows a crowd of nurses packing into an entrance of BWH and chanting, "Let us in." The union's caption reads, "We tried to go to work today because our strike is over. They locked us out." Senator Ed Markey and Mayor Michelle Wu joined BWH nurses for an impassioned rally outside the hospital Thursday afternoon, joining a list of state and local officials expressing support for the labor action. MGB home care nurses also scheduled a rally in Somerville with elected officials for Friday morning at 10 a.m. as their strike continues. The BWH nurses are also scheduled to continue their picket lines Friday, stating they will picket 24/7 outside the main hospital until the lockout ends. Bob?
Thank you, Dottie. Now turning to the opinion page under the subheading Healthcare, Safe Needle Disposal Growing Issue in Mass Homes. And this is by Irina Butler, who is the Executive Director of the Pharmaceutical Product Stewardship Work Group. As more healthcare shifts into the home, at-home injections have become a normal part of daily life for millions of Americans. Diabetes medications, arthritis treatments, allergy shots, and auto-injectors all make care more accessible when managing chronic conditions. But they leave behind a growing stream of used needles and other medical sharps that pose a challenge for keeping households and waste streams safe. Every year, more than 3 billion injections are administered outside traditional healthcare settings in the United States. In Massachusetts alone, households generate an estimated 2 million used needles every week. Yet, despite how common at-home injections have become, many people aren't sure how to dispose of used needles and sharps properly. Research shows that almost two-thirds, 64%, of patients using sharps at home have never been taught how to dispose of them properly. Without clear directions, convenience often wins out. 75% of patients reported improperly disposing of sharps, placing used sharps in household trash or recycling. Clear local guidance is especially important because disposal rules for sharps vary widely across the country. While some states allow residents to package sharps in a secure container and throw them away in household trash, Massachusetts takes a different approach. Under state law, used needles, syringes, lancets, and other sharps cannot be discarded in household trash or recycling at all and must be taken to an approved collection site. Luckily, there are over 100 resources across Massachusetts to make this easier. MyOldMeds.com, overseen by my organization, the Pharmaceutical Product Stewardship Workgroup, PPSWG, offers an easy online locator to help Massachusetts residents find convenient disposal options for sharps and household medicines. By simply entering your zip code, you can easily find one of 118 approved sharps collection sites across the Commonwealth. Many of these sites are located in places you may already go regularly, like your local pharmacy, grocery store, or doctor's office. We also publish clear guidelines for Massachusetts residents on safety and easily disposing of sharps. This starts with finding an FDA-cleared sharps container, or alternatively, a puncture-resistant container like a leftover laundry detergent bottle, and sealing your used sharps inside. Labeling the outside of the container ensures your household stays safe. Sealed containers can be taken to an approved sharps drop-off location. Building proper sharps disposal into your healthcare routine and sharing these tools with friends and loved ones helps keep your household, community, and our environment safe. It protects the people who keep our communities running, like sanitation workers, emergency responders, waste facility staff, as well as children and pets at home who risk coming into contact with improperly discarded materials. As at-home health care continues to grow, ensuring sharps are consistently and properly disposed of will only become more important. Massachusetts has strong disposal resources already in place, but more residents should be aware of these resources and the easy options that are available for making sharps disposal simple and convenient. We encourage everyone in Massachusetts who uses medical sharps or cares for someone who does to review the resources available and share these free and simple tools with others. Safe sharps disposal is already an easy step. We just need to make sure more people are aware of the benefits. Together, we can ensure these important medications do what they're designed to, help people manage their health better and more conveniently while keeping Massachusetts families and communities safe and healthy. Dottie?
Thanks, Bob. Suspect in Charlie Kirk killing said he wishes he hadn't done it. Roommate says in video by Hannah Schoenbaum and Matthew Brown out of Provo, Utah. The defendant in Charlie Kirk's killing told his roommate he wishes he hadn't done it the day after the conservative activist was shot in the neck while speaking to a crowd at Utah Valley University. A recording played in court revealed Thursday. Lance Twiggs, who was also defendant Tyler Robinson's romantic partner, said in an interview with law enforcement that the interaction with Robinson happened in their apartment in southeastern Utah, more than 200 miles from where Kirk was shot. Later that same day, and only about an hour before turning himself in, Robinson posted, "It was me at UVU yesterday," in a chat room on the Discord social media platform, according to investigators and messages shown by prosecutors. Robinson is charged with aggravated murder and has not entered a plea. He turned himself in a day after the fatal shooting of Kirk, a close ally of President Donald Trump, credited with helping galvanize young voters for the Republic in the 2024 election. Ammunition found in the gun used to kill Kirk had engravings that included, "Hey, fascist, catch." And if you read this, you are gay, prosecutors said. Robinson appeared to furrow his brow and smirk when text messages he sent to Twiggs about engraving bullets were displayed in the courtroom Thursday. His family sat behind him, and Robinson's mom cried as the Discord messages were read aloud. She rubbed the shoulder of one of Robinson's brothers, who listened with his head bowed. Defense attorneys unsuccessfully fought the public release of the statements from Twiggs and the chat room messages. Excuse me. They argued prosecutors would characterize the material as a confession, undermining Robinson's right to a fair trial. But after prolonged debate that included an attorney for Kirk's family arguing for the material to be publicly released, State District Judge Tony Graff allowed a redacted version of the video interview to be played. Some parts were blacked out, with only audio. Prosecutors allege Robinson confessed in a note to Twiggs that read, "I had the opportunity to take out Charlie Kirk, and I'm going to take it." In that note, shown in full for the first time Thursday, Robinson added that he was likely dead or facing a lengthy prison sentence, prosecutors said. Robinson separately sent a text to Twiggs, allegedly saying he targeted Kirk because he, I quote, "had enough of his hatred," end of quote. State Bureau of Investigation agent Brian Davis recounted the messages exchanged between Twiggs and Robinson under questioning by a prosecutor Thursday. Included were texts from Robinson worrying about leaving fingerprints on a rifle that belonged to his grandfather, which authorities believe he used to shoot Kirk. Other messages discussed engravings on bullet casings. Twiggs spoke to authorities on September 12th, 2 days after Kirk was assassinated, while speaking to a crowd of thousands, and again on April 20th, Davis said, He was given immunity for the statements, meaning what Twiggs said cannot be used against him in a potential criminal case. Prosecutors contend the shooting endangered others at Kirk's campus event, an aggravating circumstance that could make the crime punishable by death under Utah law. Robinson also faces possible sentence enhancements based on the claims by prosecutors that he targeted Kirk because of his political views. Twiggs said in the April interview that Robinson sometimes talked about politics, including Trump, But Twigg said he never heard Robinson talk about Kirk before the shooting. The defendant also did not talk much about gender issues or LGBTQ rights, Twiggs testified. Graff will decide at the conclusion of this week's preliminary hearing if prosecutors have enough evidence to bring Robinson to trial. Robinson's attorneys have not commented on his guilt or innocence, but have sought to get the death penalty taken off the table, so far unsuccessfully. Charlie Kirk's parents and widow, Erica Kirk, sat a few rows back from Robinson's family on Thursday. Senator Mike Lee, a Utah Republican, also was in attendance. Attorneys for the Kirks and the media urged the judge to make Twiggs's statements and other evidence public. Kirk family lawyer Jeffrey Neiman said they had waited 10 months for the hearing, but at times had been denied the chance, I quote, to meaningfully observe, end of quote. It. Neiman asked that all evidence against Robinson be displayed openly and in real time during the week's hearing. The judge responded that not all evidence would be openly displayed, and he needed to protect the rights of both victims and the defendant. Investigators say Robinson went to a rooftop near where Kirk was speaking and shot him once through the neck as the activist was taking questions from a crowd of several thousand people. Kirk was declared dead after being taken to a hospital. Bob?
Thank you, Dottie. And real quick, returning to the BizSmart section with the Market Watch, we had Dow Jones was up 139.02 to 52,487.41. S&P 500 was up 60.93 to 7,543.64. And NASDAQ was up 336.24 to 26,206.89. And I see we've come to the end of our time with you, so I will read today's horoscope. If today's your birthday, July 10th, happy birthday. And here's your horoscope. It's your year of Kalpa Vriksha. In Hindu tradition, the Kalpa Vriksha is a divine tree associated with abundance and fulfilled wishes. A single good decision branches into opportunities you couldn't have predicted at the start. Age-old family tensions ease, beginning a harmonious era. Your energy returns in a way that makes life feel bigger and more inviting. Luxury entirely suited you. More highlights, Sagittarius and Pisces adore you, and your lucky numbers are 5, 20, 24, 15, and 7. And this has been Bob
and Dottie
reading from the July 10th issue of the Boston Herald. We thank you so much for listening and wish you a fabulous Friday.
This is the Talking Information Center, a window to independence through local volunteers reading over 300 newspapers, magazines, and books specific to your community.
Now available on your smart speaker by saying, play radio station, Talking Information Center.
For comments and more information, call 781-834-4400 or visit ticnetwork.org.
Thank you for listening.
WBBF Middleborough, WRRS Middleborough, WRRS LP Pittsfield, WLLO Londonderry, WBAL LP Athol, WDJ. And Framingham.
Coming up next on the Talking Information Center, it's the Washington Post. Please stay tuned.
Hello, this is Jean at the Talking Information Center reading the Washington Post. It's Friday, July 10, 2026. Rubio tries to enlist other nations in Antifa fight, but some allies recoil. By Ellen Nakashima, John Hudson, and Adam Taylor. Secretary of State Marco Rubio has invited senior ministers from more than 60 countries to a meeting next week about what the Trump administration views as a major peril, the resurgence of transnational far-left terrorism, according to documents reviewed by the Washington Post. The meeting has prompted consternation among career and political U.S. officials, some European allies, and independent analysts who do not see the threat in the same terms. Some U.S. officials told the Post that they worry it is part of a Trump administration effort to use powerful counterterrorism tools to crack down on U.S. activists they view as left-wing extremists. The administration's counterterrorism czar, Sebastian Gorka, has had discussions with colleagues about using foreign terrorism labels for Antifa to justify going after Americans with links to the movement, a loosely knit association of far-left activists who militantly oppose fascism and right-wing ideologies, three current and former U.S. officials said. A linkage to foreign terrorist groups can unlock certain investigative tools, such as surveillance, said one U.S. counterterrorism official, who, like several other officials interviewed for this article, spoke on the condition of anonymity to describe internal discussions and to avoid retribution. Gorka did not respond to a request for comment. State Department spokesman Tommy Pigott said the event was organized because far-left terrorism is an old threat reemerging with strong transnational links and new convergences. Because this threat has not been adequately addressed in the past, each engagement, designation, or security assistance program creates a compounding effect supporting countermeasures at home and abroad, Pigott said in a statement. Some Trump administration officials fear that a future Democratic administration could use the tactic against conservative activists, one administration official said. The idea is you're setting a precedent for a future Gavin Newsom administration to turn these authorities on conservatives, the official said, referring to the California governor who is widely expected to make a 2028 White House run. The use of these tactics has raised concerns among career and political officials inside the Justice Department and the White House Counsel's Office, the administration officials said, adding that some U.S. officials have decided not to attend the July 16 event at the State Department. Asked for comment, a White House official said that the characterization of such concerns does not represent the prevailing feeling in the White House, and accused Democrats of having weaponized national security tools against their conservative political opponents. The White House official pointed to a passage in the Trump administration's counterterrorism strategy released in May, which states, "We will not permit the weaponization of America's unparalleled CT capabilities for partisan purposes." That document also states, "Our counterterrorism powers will not be used to target our fellow Americans who simply disagree with us." Like Gorka, White House Deputy Chief of Staff Stephen Miller is among those who have shown enthusiasm for taking a hard-line approach to left-wing extremists in the United States. During a White House roundtable last fall, he expressed support for designating Antifa a foreign terrorist organization. It's true, Miller said when the president asked for his opinion. There are extensive foreign ties. I think that would be a very valid step to take. But achieving that status for Antifa would be a stretch, experts say. U.S. law requires a group be foreign to be designated. If it has any significant domestic presence, it cannot be designated, said Jason Blazakis, who ran the State Department's designation process for 10 years before leaving in 2018. Elsewhere in the government, discomfort with the administration's direction is such that at meetings of national security officials from various agencies, some intelligence analysts have declined to brief on Antifa because they do not regard Antifa as a serious counterterrorism threat, according to one person familiar with the matter. Officials from some foreign governments speaking on the condition of anonymity to avoid being seen as criticizing the administration expressed dismay about the Rubio invitation, citing what they call its vague aims and the short notice. The invitation, a copy of which was shown to the Post, was issued last week, with RSVPs due this Friday, they said. Several told the Post that their country's foreign minister or interior minister was unlikely to attend, citing the busy diplomatic schedule over summer, which includes an annual security conference next week in Aspen, Colorado. Some said, too, they were unsure why they had been invited. We don't have Antifa, said one European diplomat. I don't think we can find any reason why we would be interested in attending such an event, said another. Our law enforcement authorities have not focused on left-wing terrorism because this is not considered a high-priority threat in our country, said a third. The invitation list, reviewed by the Post, included most European nations, larger Latin American countries, and several Asian states, including India, Indonesia, and Singapore. The State Department did not respond to a request seeking to understand how the list of invitees was drawn up. President Donald Trump has made no secret of his disdain for Antifa, going so far as to issue an executive order in the fall, branding it a domestic terrorist organization, a rhetorical label that experts say carries no legal weight. Trump issued the order after the killing of conservative activist Charlie Kirk, whose mobilization of the youth vote helped propel Trump back to the White House. Legal proceedings began this week in the case of Kirk's alleged killer. The order was followed by the issuance of National Security Presidential Memorandum 7, which directed the Justice Department to investigate and disrupt networks, entities, and organizations that foment political violence. The document states that Kirk's alleged killer engraved the bullets used in the killing with so-called anti-fascist rhetoric. That led to a criminal investigation that culminated last month in lengthy prison sentences given to several members of what prosecutors called an Antifa cell. One defendant received 100 years for their roles last summer in a protest outside an Immigration and Customs Enforcement facility in Texas, during which a police officer was shot. The person sentenced to 100 years was convicted of attempted murder. The others received prison terms of 30 to 70 years on charges such as rioting, providing support to terrorists, and conspiracy to use and carry explosives. Antifa, short for anti-fascist, is a decentralized movement without a clear command structure or leader, reflecting a range of ideologies mostly on the political left, from anarchism to communism and everything in between. Unlike left-wing extremist groups of the 1960s and 1970s, such as Weather Underground, Antifa does not issue manifestos or claim responsibility for actions. Analysts say it can be difficult to categorize left-wing violence. Is the killing of a healthcare executive over perceived corporate greed, as the suspect Luigi Mangione is alleged to have done, a left-wing act? And though there is some upswing of political violence in the United States, to date, left-wing violent extremism has typically been less lethal than other forms of terrorism, said Bruce Hoffman, senior fellow for counterterrorism at the Council on Foreign Relations. A concept note sent to invitees and U.S. diplomats this week and reviewed by the Post characterizes next week's event as a ministerial on the resurgence of political terrorism. But it makes clear that the focus is on far-left terrorists who, the note says, are increasingly turning to organized deadly violence to advance their political objectives. The ministerial is an opportunity to strengthen cooperation in intelligence sharing and law enforcement, the note says. But terrorism experts say that such framing inflates the threat posed by left-wing extremists and underestimates the true scope of the challenge in combating terrorism broadly. This is the politicization of intelligence, and it's dangerous because what they're doing is basically playing partisan politics with counterterrorism and only looking at a sliver of the overall threat, said Colin P. Clark, executive director of the SUFON Center, who has testified before Congress on numerous occasions as an expert witness on terrorism issues. Several current and former counterterrorism officials across Republican and Democratic administrations, as well as Europeans themselves, say the Trump's administration's emphasis is misapplied. The Europeans were much more concerned about right-wing terrorism than left-wing terrorism, in the first Trump administration and the Biden administration, said one former official who worked in both. That is still where most Europeans are, according to U.S. and European officials. In late May, the State Department held a meeting in The Hague on Antifa and left-wing terrorism, convening law enforcement and counterterrorism officials from mostly European countries, according to two people familiar with the event. The Dutch declined to co-host, so it took place at the U.S. Embassy there, one person said. The event, according to these people, fell flat. Many of the invitees' view was, "We don't see it quite the way you do," said one of the people. That was followed in early June by a gathering at the U.S. Institute of Peace to try to convince State Department personnel that far-left political terrorists were a growing threat to the country. But that event apparently was also a dud, according to Puck News. About an hour into the event, organizers sent out an email blast telling people they could still join if they wanted, Puck reported. Undeterred, the State Department in mid-June sent a cable to more than 20 U.S. embassies from Argentina and Mexico to Italy and Albania, seeking information on far-left extremist groups, according to two people familiar with the matter. Several have responded, but none has indicated they concur with the administration's assessment of the threat, one person said. In November, the State Department announced the designations of four European groups as foreign terrorist organizations, including a militant group in Germany that calls itself Antifa Ost. Two more were in Greece and one in Italy. Designation, which is done by the Secretary of State, is based on criteria that include the assessment that the group poses a direct threat to U.S. national security interests. The designations of the four groups were met with skepticism among experts. "They're very peculiar," said Blazakas, who is now a professor at Middlebury Institute and teaches about violent extremism. "Those groups have carried out acts of vandalism. They've harmed individuals, but they don't have a casualty to their name." Authorities in Germany also do not see a significant threat. The security authorities' assessment is that the potential threat posed by the group has recently decreased significantly, an Interior Ministry spokesperson told reporters in November, noting that Antifa Ost leaders and particularly violent members were either in custody or already convicted. European governments have largely declined to label Antifa as a terrorism organization, despite pressure from far-right parties. In the Netherlands, the center-right government rejected a parliamentary motion to designate Antifa, with the country's justice minister telling Parliament in May that it did not meet the legal threshold because there was no evidence it was an organization rather than an amorphous movement. That month, a State Department official told reporters that the agency had taken unprecedented steps to dismantle transnational far-left and anarchist terrorism, including Antifa-aligned groups, asserting that the number of incidents involving these groups had increased sharply over the past decade in the United States and Europe. The official, who spoke on the condition of anonymity under rules set by the department, said the administration had heard from foreign partners that they were seeing different groups starting to converge. The administration's rhetoric is consistent with the language of its counterterrorism strategy, which calls for the rapid identification and neutralization of violent secular political groups whose ideology is anti-American, radically pro-transgender, and anarchist. The strategy directs the use of all tools constitutionally available to us to map them at home, identify their membership, map their ties to international organizations like Antifa, and use law enforcement tools to cripple them operationally before they can maim or kill the innocent. It does not, as did the 2018 counterterrorism strategy issued in Trump's first term, mention nationalist neo-Nazi groups with anti-Western views that have attacked Muslims and left-wing groups. We have to be objective about identifying threats, not politically selective, Hoffman said. If I were to rack and stack priorities, left-wing terrorists wouldn't be in my top three, Clark said. Democrats seek a way forward amid finger-pointing in Maine. By Dan Merica and Alexei Kosev. Democrats in Maine sought to swiftly move on from Graham Platner's failed Senate campaign Thursday. But as they began picking up the pieces of a campaign that flamed out as spectacularly as it had caught on, they remained divided and uncertain about how to keep the movement he had energized intact. Several candidates who rushed to replace him late Wednesday and early Thursday, following his 11-minute conspiracy-laden withdrawal video, told The Washington Post they would not accept Platner's endorsement. Meanwhile, the Maine Democratic Party worked to outline the details of the process to select a new nominee, which must be complete by July 27 under state law. State leaders met to consider a range of plans for holding a nominating convention. One of the key hang-ups, said a person familiar with the plans, is how to elect the delegates who vote on the new candidate in a representative way. They spoke on the condition of anonymity to discuss internal deliberations. A host of other questions remained unanswered, from how a nominating convention would be run to whether and how to vet potential replacements for a candidate who left the race because of a host of scandals, including a sexual assault allegation that he denied. Platner privately told campaign staff on Wednesday night that he planned to officially file the paperwork removing himself from the ballot on Monday. Two former Platner aides who were on the call told The Washington Post. That means Platner will wait until the deadline under state law to officially end his Senate campaign, a decision that could cause heartburn for Maine Democrats eager to move on from the candidate. While officials plotted a path forward, many top Democrats in Maine spent the day debating whether Platner's exit and his decision to bitterly blame the establishment for forcing him out would hurt the eventual nominee. Democrats are eager to field a strong challenger against Republican Senator Susan Collins in a contest that could decide control of the Senate. Even some former Platner aides worried Thursday that he damaged what he had built. He spent a year helping people to believe in a truly feel-good brand of politics that brought them together, often literally, and called out the real corruption baked into our political system, said a former Platner aide who spoke on the condition of anonymity because of the still raw nerves among Democrats. Then, for 11 minutes on Wednesday night, he told the same people that their work didn't matter and that no matter what they did, it was impossible to make change because invisible forces around them would never allow it. Some Democrats said Platner's video threatened to rally his supporters against the state party and damage anyone nominated through their process. That video really made no one proud except for probably Graham Plattner. It was quite unfortunate. Adam Green, the head of a progressive group that supported Plattner until this week, said on CNN, "This was certainly a setback for progressive causes." Others, however, contended that the video missed the mark so spectacularly that it could unite the party. The video was 11 minutes of grievance and self-pity that even diehard Plattner supporters have struggled to defend, said Ian Russell, a Democratic operative who works in Maine politics. "He's shown no grace or even any scintilla of responsibility for his actions," Russell said. "But the video was so over the top and grievance-filled that it will make it easier for the party to come together." The tenor of Plattner's exit was important to him, a person familiar with its production told the Post, and was a condition of his decision to suspend his campaign. Plattner, while holed up in his rural Maine home this week, told his most loyal aides that he would only suspend his campaign if he were allowed to say everything he wanted, the person said. His remarks picked at a wound that the Democratic Party has spent a decade trying to heal. In 2016, supporters of Senator Bernie Sanders, independent of Vermont, insurgent presidential campaign, blamed party officials for rigging the unexpectedly competitive Democratic primary for the more moderate Hillary Clinton. A unity message at that summer's nominating convention failed to tamp down on the bitterness, and Clinton's loss to President Donald Trump provided fuel for all sides in an acrimonious ideological split within the party. Since then, as additional outsider candidates upend the Democratic establishment, party leaders have feuded with a restive progressive wing that argues Democrats are stifling the excitement of their base in search of more moderate candidates. The Maine Democratic Party must now consolidate voters behind whoever emerges as the replacement nominee, someone they hope will appeal to both progressive and moderate voters needed to win the state. Four of the candidates vying to take over for Plattner, former state senator Troy Jackson, brewery owner Dan Kleban, former congressional candidate Jordan Wood, and former top Maine health official Nirav Shah, all told the Post they would not accept Plattner's endorsement. "This race should no longer be about Plattner," Shah said. "It should be about the people who supported him and uniting them to defeat Senator Collins." But each candidate made clear steps on Thursday toward winning over Plattner's base. Kleban said he would not vote for Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat of New York, for Senate leadership, something that helped burnish Plattner's outsider image. Wood, after declining to endorse Plattner, said he has always been aligned with Graham on most issues and noted they were both young progressive reformers. And Jackson officially announced his run by casting himself as a fighter for working-class people in Plattner's image, and later pledged to support Medicare for All in the Senate, the universal health care plan that Plattner promoted. "I've been fighting for that movement my whole life, and I'm sure as hell not backing down now when this fight is needed most," Jackson said. At his formal campaign launch Thursday in Freeport, Shah made a direct appeal to Plattner's supporters. "You have an important place in this campaign, and we welcome your voices," he said. "This campaign represents the values that we all care about." Bev Uhlenhock, the former chair of the Maine Democratic Party, said keeping Plattner's supporters aligned with Democrats will be vital to whoever succeeds him on the ballot. "We've seen thousands of newly engaged Mainers in politics through the Plattner campaign," Uhlenhock said. "It's vital to the eventual Senate candidate and for the future of the Maine Democratic Party as a whole that those folks continue to feel engaged. They need to be heard and understood, even if their voices sound angry." But Marcia Myers, chair of the Hancock County Democratic Committee, said she did not detect the resentment expressed by Plattner in his exit video filtering down to voters. "The momentum that Plattner built mattered to people," Myers said, "and the Democrats she has spoken to are motivated. People are coming out of the woodwork wanting to be delegates for the convention to replace Plattner, she said. He said it in his comments last night. This is about the mission, not the man. And I really think people are embracing that idea, Myers said. I'm sure there may be some who feel they want to disconnect, but most of the people I've talked to have been in the trenches, and they're going to stay there. Trump's proposed triumphal arch clears another key hurdle. By Dan Diamond. A federal commission Thursday advanced President Donald Trump's triumphal arch project after hearing nearly 3 hours of public opposition, delivering a key win for the president's hope to begin building the towering 250-foot-tall structure. The National Capital Planning Commission's vote does not represent final approval for the controversial project, which would be constructed in Memorial Circle, a traffic roundabout near Arlington National Cemetery. The commission also requested that administration officials and architects provide more information about the project before final consideration, which its chairman said could come in September. But Thursday's vote allows Trump's plan to clear another logistical hurdle, with the president eager to begin construction on the arch and potentially conclude the project during his term. I think it's long overdue as something that should be seriously considered in the city, said Paul Ingracia, a Trump appointee at the General Services Administration who serves as one of the panel's commissioners. The panel voted 8-1 to advance the project, with commissioners who represent the Trump administration and congressional Republicans all in favor of the arch, and one commissioner who represents Washington voting against it. Three more commissioners who represent Washington voted present. About 30 people, including architects, Washington residents, military veterans, and the parents of soldiers buried in Arlington National Cemetery, weighed in before the commission's vote. Some criticized the commission's review as too rushed, noting that past proposals to build monuments in the city have undergone more thorough scrutiny. Others, including Michael Lemon, a Vietnam War veteran who is suing to block the project, told the commission that Trump's large arch would disrupt the experience of visiting Arlington National Cemetery and interfere with the intent of nearby monuments. Reject this hasty and inappropriate proposal. Respect public opinion and engage in a deliberative design process to ensure that we end up with a fitting memorial for America's 250th anniversary. Priya Jain, who chairs the Heritage Conservation Committee at the Society of Architectural Historians, told the commission. Trump has said that Washington, as the nation's capital city, deserves a triumphal arch that is larger than other arches around the world, including the 164-foot-tall Arc de Triomphe in Paris. The president and his deputies have also cited a 1925 plan authorized by Congress to build a structure at the site where Memorial Circle is now. It was meant to be built for many years, Trump said in the Oval Office in May, arguing that he has the authority to pursue the project without new congressional authorization. We don't need anything from Congress. Democrats have disagreed and insisted that the project must undergo congressional review. Thursday's vote was not a surprise. Trump had remade the commission's leaders, installing his staff secretary, Will Scharf, as its chairman, and appointing other allies to the panel, positioning his projects for favorable reviews. The commission previously approved Trump's planned White House ballroom despite significant public opposition. The commission's staff members, who include urban planners that are not politically appointed and serve across multiple administrations, recommended Thursday that the administration shrink the arch's design to comply with the Height of Buildings Act, a federal law that restricts most construction in Washington to a maximum height of 130 feet. The Trump administration and Scharf have separately argued that the Height Act should not apply to the arch and other federal projects. Scharf on Thursday said he found the Trump administration's argument that the Height Act did not apply to Trump's 250-foot arch compelling, and that the commission should resolve the matter at a future meeting. My view is that today we are just considering this project for preliminary approval, and that as a result, it's not necessary for us to take up this broader issue of the applicability of the Height of Buildings Act to federal construction, he said. The Commission of Fine Arts, another federal panel packed with Trump's allies, voted in May to give final approval to the project. Trump administration officials have declined to specify how much the project will cost or how it will be specifically funded, although have said that they plan to draw on a mix of private and public funds. The president's proposed arch has drawn significant public feedback as it has advanced. The National Park Service reported receiving more than 100,000 comments about the project during a 10-day public comment period last month. 52% of Americans oppose the planned arch, compared with 21% who favor it, according to an April Washington Post ABC News Ipsos poll. Evan Cash, who serves on the commission as the representative of D.C. Council Chairman Phil Mendelson, was the lone commissioner to vote against the project Thursday. Cash raised several concerns, including whether the Trump administration was attempting to evade congressional restrictions on building monuments, and whether a current or future president should be able to easily build tall projects that change the character of Washington. Our skyline didn't happen by accident, Cash said. Trump appointees Thursday insisted that the idea was broadly popular. Ingrassia said that a model arch currently displayed at a fair organized on the National Mall to celebrate the nation's anniversary had drawn positive comments. That display was attended by veterans, families, American citizens across the political spectrum, he said. Some commenters Thursday urged the Trump administration to build the arch in a different place, such as a site near Nationals Park. Several commenters also said they felt the current site near Arlington National Cemetery was disrespectful and would be disruptive. The Trump administration is proposing to work on the project for 20 hours per day for up to 3 years, a pace that could allow it to finish the work before Trump leaves office. Under this plan, families would lower their loved ones into the ground to the sound of pile drivers, taps against concrete pumps, Lindsay Burnett, who said she served with the Army in Iraq 2 decades ago, told the commission, "We ask our dead for everything. The least we owe them is silence." Scharf later said he appreciated those comments and asked the team overseeing the arch to develop some sort of mitigation plan so funerals at the cemetery aren't disrupted by construction. "This is an example of how public testimony can really inform our commission's deliberative process," said Scharf. 90% of U.S. adults have this syndrome, but most have never heard of it. By Erica Sloan. Susan Gilchrist, a preventive cardiologist and epidemiologist, sees patients all the time at the University of North Carolina Cardiovascular Kidney Metabolic, CKM, Syndrome Clinic, who don't know what CKM is and are not sure why they're in her clinic. It's not surprising. CKM syndrome was only recently coined in 2023 by the American Heart Association, AHA, and roughly 9 in 10 U.S. adults, about the same number of people estimated to have it, have never heard of it. CKM syndrome is not one disease, but rather a broad disorder that recognizes the overlap between cardiovascular, kidney, and metabolic conditions such as diabetes and obesity, said Muthiah Vadugannathan, a cardiologist at Brigham and Women's Hospital, who has conducted landmark studies on CKM syndrome. Doctors have long known that people often have more than one of these conditions at once. CKM syndrome reflects a newer understanding that the very same factors, specifically extra weight, high blood pressure, high blood sugar, abnormal cholesterol, and reduced kidney function, can contribute to the onset and progression of all three types of disease, Vadugannathan said. Researchers have defined CKM syndrome as a four-stage continuum, reflecting how symptoms and risk factors progressively pile up, raising the likelihood of a heart event or kidney failure. Stage 1 includes people with extra fat tissue, defined as a body mass index, BMI, of 25 or higher, or a waist circumference of 88 centimeters or greater in women and 102 centimeters or greater in men, and those with dysfunctional fat tissue, who may not have a larger body but show signs of poor glucose tolerance, like prediabetes. Because BMI can't distinguish lean body mass from fat, it can misclassify short or muscular people as overweight, which is why Gilchrist said experts often use it in tandem with the other metrics here to pinpoint those who fall in this risk bucket. Stage 2 includes people with metabolic risk factors that often flow from extra fat tissue, like high blood levels of a type of fat called triglycerides, high blood pressure, metabolic syndrome, a cluster of symptoms that can include either of the previous two, as well as a large waist, poor cholesterol, and high blood sugar, diabetes, or chronic kidney disease. At this stage, people still tend to be asymptomatic, Baduganathan said. Getting categorized requires blood work, usually done at a routine physical. Stage 3 includes those from prior stages who've developed pre-symptomatic heart disease, such as atherosclerosis or heart failure, and those with very high-risk CKD or a risk greater than 20% of a heart event in the next 10 years based on the AHA's PREVENT calculator. Since the disease might still be silent at this point, a person would be classified when their doctor orders screenings based on the above risk factors. Stage 4 includes people from the above stages who've been diagnosed with a stroke, heart failure, coronary heart disease, peripheral artery disease, or atrial fibrillation. This stage, which can occur with kidney disease, stage 4B, or without, stage 4A, covers the most severe outcomes of CKM syndrome and brings a high risk of future heart events, too. This framework has helped Gilchrist explain to patients why weight matters for health. Carrying extra weight alone does not equate to disease, but it may put you on a path toward it. A large waist circumference and high blood sugar, in particular, are signs of what Gilchrist called metabolically dangerous fat. It releases inflammatory proteins into the blood and can rev up your body's fight-or-flight stress state, she said. That combination can raise blood pressure and levels of certain fats in the blood and make cells resistant to insulin, which helps with sugar uptake, dumping even more sugar in the blood. Both high blood sugar and high blood pressure can damage the tiny blood vessels feeding the kidneys, harming their ability to filter waste and extra fluid, said Joshua Joseph, an endocrinologist at the Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center. The fluid backup increases blood volume, straining the heart and further raising blood pressure, Joseph said, setting off a downward spiral toward heart events and kidney failure. The CKM framework was only formalized in 2023, and the physician guidelines for identifying it and managing it in June 2026, so the syndrome is just now gaining recognition. CKM syndrome affects 90% of Americans because it's broadly defined to capture everyone on the continuum, from those who might feel well but have early metabolic risk factors to those with full-fledged heart disease. It doesn't mean that 90% of Americans require treatment, Vaduganathan said. The goal isn't to over-medicalize but to push prevention. It's more that 90% of Americans should be aware that they are at least at risk for progression of one or more of these conditions, metabolic, kidney, or heart, and that early lifestyle management can help. Gilchrist pointed out that the guidelines even describe a stage zero, which includes the other 10% of Americans. They may not technically have the syndrome, but are still at risk for developing it if they don't actively subscribe to a healthy lifestyle, she said. So much of the American public falls between stage 1 and stage 4 CKM syndrome because of our typical lifestyle behaviors, said Joseph. We live in a 24 hours a day society where we may struggle to eat healthy foods, be physically active, and get enough sleep, he said. Roughly 20% of U.S. adults also use tobacco products, he added, which ratchets up risk, too. But our behaviors also occur in the context of our environments, Joseph pointed out. You might live in a rural area without easy access to a grocery store, or in a city lacking green spaces or other safe areas to go out and be active. Or maybe your home is surrounded by factories that pump pollutants into the air. Both the environmental foundation and the lifestyle behaviors are levers we're trying to move, Joseph said. At early stages, treatment centers on lifestyle interventions. For instance, we know that a Mediterranean-style diet can not only help mitigate blood pressure and blood sugar, but has also been shown to reduce long-term cardiovascular risk, Joseph said. Beyond diet, the AHA guidelines for CKM syndrome also note being physically active, avoiding nicotine products, and getting quality sleep. Plus, in people with extra weight, behavioral weight loss programs led by clinicians. A handful of long-used medications are also still recommended to tackle specific risk factors and diseases in people at higher stages. For example, metformin to lower blood sugar, statins to combat high cholesterol, and angiotensin-converting enzyme, ACE inhibitors, to control blood pressure. But the biggest focus for people across the CKM spectrum is on new medications with broader effects across organs, the experts said. For instance, glucagon-like peptides, GLP-1s, can help with weight and lower blood sugar by slowing down digestion, which has been shown to benefit the heart and kidneys. Then there's sodium glucose co-transporter 2, SGL-2 inhibitors, which help you urinate out sugar and are also proven to reduce heart failure admissions and stabilize kidney function, Joseph said. And non-steroidal mineralocorticoid receptor antagonists, NSMRAs, can limit fluid backup in the kidneys with upstream benefits for the heart. We're in such a great era of medicine, Gilchrist said, because we don't just have drugs that lower one risk factor. With the CKM framework, we can find people at risk, and we can offer medicines that may actually help them stay out of the hospital and live longer. U.S. intensifies strikes on Iran's coast along Strait of Hormuz. By Rachel Chason and Susan Hademas. U.S. forces hit 90 targets overnight, mostly along Iran's coastline with the Strait of Hormuz, stepping up renewed strikes after President Donald Trump said he thought a tentative truce was over. Iran, in turn, launched a barrage of drones and missiles at Jordan and countries in the Persian Gulf. The intensifying tit-for-tat strikes, now in their second day, came after huge crowds in Tehran vowed revenge against the United States, during elaborate funeral rites this week for their assassinated supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, and after Trump called Iran's leaders scum. Analysts said the conflict could be escalating into a destructive new phase. The danger is more significant than people recognize, said William F. Wexler, the senior director of the Rafik Hariri Center and Middle East programs at the Atlantic Council, a Washington think tank. Going back to war doesn't mean that there will be the same limitations as before. There is a real risk of escalation, he said, pointing to Trump's warnings in recent days that the U.S. could hit Iranian energy infrastructure and desalinization plants. Over the past 2 days, the U.S. struck port cities in Iran's south and a railway in Iran's north, killing at least 14 people and wounding 78 others, according to the country's health ministry. Iran said it fired at U.S. targets in Bahrain, Kuwait, and Qatar, in addition to the Muwafaq Salti Air Base, a military facility used by U.S. forces in Jordan, which had been largely spared Iranian attacks since the beginning of the war in February. The main sticking point for both sides, Wexler said, is control of the Strait of Hormuz. While Iran interprets its initial agreement with the U.S., which was met with relief and cautious optimism when the sides agreed to it last month, as giving it control of the vital waterway, the U.S. believes the opposite. They're trying to win on the battlefield what they couldn't win at the negotiating table, Wexler said. The initial framework to end the war was followed by the start of negotiations aimed at forging a more durable peace accord within 60 days. But less than half that time had elapsed when Trump on Wednesday said he believed the ceasefire had collapsed following Iranian attacks on ships passing through the strait. Dania Thafer, executive director of Gulf International Forum, a Washington think tank, said that the most significant development in recent days was the U.S. Treasury on Tuesday revoking its authorization of Iranian oil sales. Under the term of the initial agreement, the U.S. Treasury had waived sanctions on Iranian oil through August 21, allowing the Iranian government access to a key source of revenue. Revoking that authorization is a huge deal, said Thafer, who is based in Washington and Qatar. Iran thinks that the U.S. is trying to undermine its leverage, she said, first by helping to broker a deal directly between Israel and Lebanon, which curbed Iranian influence, and then by encouraging ships transiting the Strait of Hormuz to take a route along the coast of Oman, rather than registering with Iranian officials. This could very well escalate to a full-scale war, she said, or they could de-escalate and resume talks, but the Iranians are almost at the point where they think negotiation is pointless. The U.S. strikes in recent days, the first round of which hit 80 targets, according to the U.S. military, and the new barrage of 90 overnight, were intended to further degrade Iran's ability to attack commercial shipping and innocent civilian mariners in the Strait of Hormuz, U.S. Central Command said in a statement early Thursday. Targets included air defense systems, coastal surveillance assets, missile and drone storage sites, naval capabilities, and military logistics infrastructure. Iran retaliated by firing missiles and drones at U.S. military sites in partner countries in the Persian Gulf region, including Kuwait, Bahrain, and Qatar. Sirens also sounded in Jordan on Thursday, and the country's military said 8 missiles had been intercepted. A government spokesman said in a statement carried by state media that the kingdom's airspace had been breached by missiles launched by Iran. In Kuwait, the defense ministry said that it had intercepted a cruise missile and 10 drones. Bahrain's military said that it had destroyed several treacherous Iranian aerial attacks, according to a statement Thursday, and it condemned Iran's systematic hostile approach through missile and drone attacks targeting civilians in the Kingdom of Bahrain. Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, in a statement carried by Iran's semi-official Mehr News, said the attacks were a first stage and warned of further strikes on American targets in the region if the U.S. air campaign continues. The armed forces of the Islamic Republic of Iran will not allow the goals and aspirations of the foolish U.S. president to be realized with authority and under any circumstances, the statement read, and will defend the lofty ideals of the Islamic Revolution until the final victory. Democratic Party fissures are shaping Michigan's crucial Senate primary. By Karen Tumulty. The most significant battle between the Democratic Party's warring factions is taking shape in the fight over the U.S. Senate nomination in Michigan, a swing state and crucial seat for Democrats to hold if they are to have a real hope of regaining control of Congress. This week, the lines became even sharper in a race where the polling has been close. With the withdrawal of Senator Mallory McMorrow, who had been struggling for traction in a middle lane, The August 4 primary has come down to two starkly different contenders. Abdul El Sayed, a former public health official who has the backing and organizational strength of the Democratic Socialists of America and Senator Bernie Sanders, independent of Vermont, and Representative Haley Stevens, a moderate House member around whom Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, New York, and much of the Democratic establishment have rallied. While candidates aligned with and supported by the far left, and particularly the Democratic Socialist Movement, have won eye-popping victories recently in deeply blue House districts and mayor's races, the statewide contest in Michigan indicates how much firepower the party's liberal insurgency has in the heartland. Democrats are sweating their ability to hold on to a seat being vacated by Senator Gary Peters, who is retiring from the seat he has held since 2015. The presumed Republican nominee, former Congressman Mike Rogers, is regarded as formidable, given that he came within half a percentage point of beating now Senator Alyssa Slotkin, Democrat, in 2024. Thanks in part to his lack of a primary opponent, Rogers has amassed a war chest that, according to the latest financial reports in April, had reached $4.2 million. If Democrats lose Michigan's seat, their already difficult path to the net gain of four they need to reclaim a Senate majority becomes steeper. The race could also have implications in 2028. Michigan is likely to hold one of the earliest primaries in the Democratic presidential contest and a general election battleground that Donald Trump has won twice. On Tuesday, El Sayed and Stevens clashed in their first one-on-one debate. Stevens, regarded as an unsteady performer, was more focused and aggressive in her attacks than she has been to date in the campaign. The Congresswoman, in her fourth House term after flipping a district long held by Republicans in 2018, referred to herself repeatedly as a workhorse, while suggesting El Sayed lacks seriousness. "I am not trying to sell a book or a podcast. I'm the only one on this stage who doesn't have a talent agent trying to pitch me for paid speeches. And unlike my opponent, I'm not running at the first mic or camera I see," she said. "Instead, my head is down doing the work for the people of Michigan who need the work to be done." For his part, El Sayed continued to pound Stevens with claims that she is a tool of corporate interests and the pro-Israel lobby, the latter being a flashpoint in current Democratic politics, which are riven by disagreements over the war in Gaza. "If Congresswoman Stevens makes it, or Mike Rogers wins, either way, Israel will win," El Sayed said, referring to the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, which is spending millions through its super PAC to support Stevens. He added, "AI PAC is perfectly fine with either of my two opponents because they know that they will have a comfortable, reliable vote in the U.S. Senate." His answer to almost every policy question was a promise to blow up a political system in which he says corporate and special interests call the shots. "So long as corporations are buying politicians, we can't actually enact the solutions, because they're getting the policies that they signed up for when they pay for their politicians," El Sayed said. While there has been much speculation that this is a year in which the influence of the Democratic Socialist Movement is taking hold in the Democratic Party, former Michigan Governor James Blanchard, a Stevens supporter, said the voters in his state are angry, not ideological. "It's more anti-incumbent than pro-socialism," Blanchard said in an interview. "They want fighters, they want change, and they think incumbents in Congress have been too complacent." Speaking to reporters after the debate, however, Stevens defended her service on Capitol Hill. "I have been doing the work for Michigan when it matters," she said, "and I'm damn proud of it." Why this could end up the least active hurricane season in 13 years. By Matthew Cappucci. In an updated outlook released this week, researchers at Colorado State University are predicting a particularly muted Atlantic hurricane season, even indicating a possibility that no major storm makes landfall in the United States. It would be the least active season in at least 13 years. Only 9 named storms are expected basin-wide, according to the group, notably lower than the annual average of 14.4. One relatively meager tropical storm, Arthur, already skimmed along the Texas coastline from June 17 to June 18. Of the remaining 8 storms that CSU forecasts will form this year, 4 are expected to become hurricanes, and 1 should attain Category 3 or greater strength, making it a major hurricane. Because this is the forecast for the entire North Atlantic, that makes the odds of the U.S. getting hit relatively low. In fact, CSU projects only a 17% chance of a major U.S. landfall. That's down from a typical 43% chance any given season. In another sign of a turned-down season, the group's predictions for accumulated cyclone energy, ACE, run just 40% of what's typical for a season. ACE can be thought of as the seasonal total of all the heat energy extracted from the oceans and expended by storms on producing strong winds. Especially encouraging is how comparatively little ACE is forecast west of 60 degrees longitude, which is where the U.S. is located. What's driving the quiescence? It's due to the burgeoning El Niño pattern, which is expected to become the strongest on record. El Niño begins as a warming of water temperatures in the eastern tropical Pacific. That heats the air above, causing it to rise. The rising air is expected to generate more tropical systems in the Pacific, which is why it is likely to see a potentially hyperactive season. But what goes up must come down, and that rising air is mirrored by subsidence or sinking in the Atlantic. That will squash many attempts at tropical cyclone formation, reducing the overall number of storms. Moreover, El Niño patterns amplify wind shear, or disruptive changing winds with height. That will shred some disturbances before they can even grow into named storms. Tropical cyclones that do become established may be knocked off kilter by harsh upper-level winds, reducing their intensity. Water temperatures across the Atlantic are also closer to average rather than the red-hot anomalous warmth that's been characteristic of the past few hurricane seasons. Despite the encouraging signs that suggest fewer relative storms, it's important for coastal residents not to let their guard down. After all, hurricane season is still hurricane season. As with all hurricane seasons, coastal residents are reminded that it only takes one hurricane making landfall to make it an active season, wrote Colorado State forecasters. The 1992 Atlantic hurricane season, for instance, was anemic on paper when measured by total activity. Accumulated cyclone energy was 38% below average. Only one major hurricane formed. But that was Category 5, Hurricane Andrew, which lay siege to South Florida and the southern suburbs of Miami. That concludes this Friday's reading from the Washington Post. My name is Jean, and it's been my pleasure to read for you.
You were just listening to the Washington Post on the Talking Information Center. Please stay tuned for more programming, and thank you for listening.
Here's the forecast for the Boston and South Shore area on the Talking Information Center from the National Weather Service. For today, partly sunny and hot, temperatures near 90. A pop-up thunderstorm is not out of the question. Overnight clouds move in, temperatures dropping to the mid-60s. Clouds part by morning, not as hot on Saturday, temperatures in the lower 80s. The sun rose this morning at 5:18, setting at 8:22 this evening. Stay tuned for more heading your way next on the Talking Information Center.
Hey, wouldn't it be great if life came with a remote control? You know, you could hit pause when you needed to, or hit rewind, like that time you knocked down that wasp's nest.
Uh-oh.
Or that time you forgot to roll up your windows in the car wash.
Man, fantastic.
Yeah, a remote control would have come in handy then. Well, life doesn't always give you time to change the outcome, but prediabetes does. With early diagnosis and a few healthy changes like managing your weight, getting active, stopping smoking, and eating healthier, you can stop prediabetes before it leads to type 2 diabetes. It's easy to learn your risk. Take the one-minute test today at doihaveprediabetes.org. Life doesn't come with a remote control. So you're on your own with the WASPs. You have the power to take control of prediabetes. Visit doihaveprediabetes.org today. That's doihaveprediabetes.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and its Prediabetes Awareness Partners.
This is the Talking Information Center, a window to independence through local volunteers reading over